Session number 4808, reel 3.
Mr. Golding, reel 3.
One of the things which I think was a big mistake, which was made by our top people, it was explained to me later that it was done for the Dutch benefit, but I doubt that myself, and that was to create, obviously to most intelligent people, very false and phony rumours, such as that the Americans were just about to invade Java, they'd already retaken Singapore, and so on and so on and so forth. The idea being that they stated that, psychologically speaking, we were only capable of taking in the view that we would be prisoners, say, for 1 month or at the most 3 months. I think this is a terrible calumny on most of us, because I think we were quite intelligent enough to realise that the enormous hiding we'd taken, that it was going to be a matter of years. In fact, there were quite a lot of people who didn't think we were going to win the war. We were talking about what the Japanese would do with us after a peace treaty. So I think this was very bad psychology. And what it did was to make people disbelieve anything that we were told. But the man who didn't, and man I have just as much respect for as I have for Dunlop, is somebody called Lawrence Vanderpost. Have you come across him?
The writer, yes.
Who I noticed was knighted in the current honours list. He always had a very, very mysterious sort of role out there. Never really understood why he was there in the first place. He didn't seem to be attached to anybody. I rather suspect that he was sent over to organise resistance in the hills, sort of a fifth column Mackie-type resistance. But whatever happens, he got captured very early. He was a marvellous man to have around, because he spoke Japanese quite fluently. He'd been round the world, he knew what was on, what was happening. And I got quite friendly with him at one time. And he told me something which I believe had a very big help in my surviving reasonably unharmed, and that was, he said, assume that this is your life now, that you're never going anywhere else, and stop looking through the fence, and look, in other words, looking for help. Forget about the rest of the world. This is your life, and now make the best of it. And I was capable of doing that, 90%, obviously, you wouldn't be at 100%, I believe that's the healthy way to do it. I think this idea which so many of the people had, that rescue's round the corner, I believe to be harmful. And certainly I would never advocate it. It would be interesting when it comes out, or if it does come out, how the American hostages saw this. But it's much better, I believe, in that situation, to assume that, well, that's your life now, and adapt as well as you can. The other thing in Java, which was interesting, we had a man there as well named Rintoul, unusual name, R-A-N-T-O-U-L, who was, amongst other things, turned out to be the company secretary of Beecham's, the financial man. And he organised a PAYE system, which I'm not sure if it had been used in England before the war. I don't think it had, actually. But we
taxation
were paid.
System.
Yeah, well, you see, we were paid by the Japanese at a very small rate, but you were only paid if you worked. If you were off sick, you didn't get any pay. And what he did, organised the camp. Our people in the camp did. They got all the money, and then you had a sort of pay parade, and you were paid whatever you were. But he subtracted, I can't remember now how much it was, but supposing it was 10% of that, which to buy food which could went to everybody, but most of all to the people who were ill. because the people who were ill obviously needed rations more, but you didn't get rations if you didn't work. See, supposing you had 1,000 men in the camp, you got 1,000 heavy, and all 1,000 were on heavy duties, so you got 1,000 heavy duties rations, and the rations that I pointed out to you, the 3 cups of rice and the soup, that was a heavy duty ration. If you were on light duties, you got half that, and if you were sick, you got no rations at all. So, in other words, of course, we always did, even if we hadn't had any money, we would always share out. But what tended to happen, though, that by having this extra cash, because however vicious the commandants were and however brutal they were, in all the camps I was in, they never closed, the equivalent of nappy, the supply, because they were making a lot of money out of it. They'd be punishing themselves because it was run by traders who had the concession, so they had to pay very heavily for the concession, and then they would take something out of the profit as well. So that never got closed. So you could always buy some stuff if you had the money.
Yeah. What position did Rintoul have in the camp? I mean, was he a senior British officer? What gave him authority to do this?
He was an officer. He wasn't the senior one, but presumably Dunlop, who was the senior one, said this was a good idea. And in fact, curiously enough, thinking back, I can't remember anybody ever grumbling about it, because it was quite obvious everybody was going to be sick sometime or the other. I don't suppose there was a single soul who went through the whole time. And obviously you'd want food when that happened.
Did the Japanese accept sickness, or did they accuse the sick of malingering?
They accepted sickness, but on the other hand, they despised it, which was quite interesting, because they were also rather frightened. First of all, they had one big thing in their favour, that which gave them a very unfair advantage in fighting out there. They appeared to be pretty immune to malaria. They very rarely hear it. In fact, I suspect they were almost totally immune to malaria. So therefore, they hardly really believed in malaria. But on the other hand, they were very, very frightened of illnesses like typhoid and anything to do with the stomach. And so therefore, one of the things they'd do, that if you were caught, once it was bedtime, lights out, which would be when it got dark, which was very early out there, you weren't allowed to leave your hut. But it was obvious that from time to time you wanted it. For one thing, if you live on a diet of rice, you can't get through the night without going to the lavatory. And if you were caught by a guard, then he would start getting very rough. And the marvellous sort of way out of this was that all you had to remember were 2 words, which were Sakit Orang, which is sick man, and when they'd say where he's sick and you'd sort of point to his stomach, they would sort of cringe away as if so this is a very useful thing to know. But they seem to be very worried there. But on the other hand, they despise sickness like all weakness. You see, first of all, they didn't really believe in having prisoners. They considered this was a disgrace to be prisoners, so therefore we were made to feel bad. And they believed that we should have fought. And in a sense, I must admit that I do have some feeling of guilt about it. I think we surrendered much too easily, much too quickly, both in Singapore and elsewhere. That's neither here nor there. But on the other hand, they didn't think we should have been in the first place, and they didn't see any reason why they should treat us well. And in fact, they had no real way of dealing with prisoners. And the way they did it was to make us members of the army. We all really were part of the Japanese army, but at the lowest possible rank, which was recruit, and whereas other people could get promoted, we couldn't.
Was there some sort of formality in which you were inducted into the Japanese
army? I think it just happened. No, there was no formality, or at least no formality that I ever went through, anyway.
How did you know, then, that you were in the Japanese
army? Well, this is what, every now and again, mind you, it might be just their bad English, because we used to get propaganda sheets every now and again, which told us things like this, and also told us how much, it was interesting that we could find out exactly how the war was going by their sheets, because their propaganda was so crude that it told an awful lot of truth in the wrong way. For instance, when nearer the end of the war, when they were when the Americans were really island hopping in a very successful way, they would tell us where the island was and where the battle took place. So it said the Americans were all annihilated and 10 aircraft carriers were sunk, and one Japanese plane failed to return or something. Anybody who had a map or any geography knew that each time they brought this out, the Americans were one closer. So, in fact, they were telling us an awful lot.
Did you speak to the Japanese in Malay?
Yes. Japanese, where drill was concerned, so we all had to learn how to drill in Japanese, and in numbering, when they had curious techniques for this, which again led to one of our little games, which all passed life as for a time happily, was when we come back from whatever working party we'd been on, we were always counted. We had to do Japanese drill, which was still forming fours, incidentally, which was quite... And anyway, they'd have us usually in four ranks, therefore, and we would have to count. Now, the point about counting was that, first of all, that they tried to start with that going down the rank, front rank numbering in the usual way, and then multiplying by four. First of all, we quickly realised that they found this very difficult, so that everybody came up with a different answer. And then we discovered that rather good fun, that meant a lot of trouble in some ways, was somebody in one of the ranks to hide with when the counting took place, so that they'd get the numbers totally wrong and it would lead to rows and screams and all the rest. But they won that one in the end, because they made us, we'd have to count all the way down all four ranks in the end. So they got the numbers that way. But we had a lot of innocent fun out of that. They'd always finish up somebody or the other getting bashed, but that was life. You had to pay for your pleasures.
Were there any other methods of twitting the Japanese?
Oh, yes. What was we played some rough games. One of the rough games we played was a sort of truth and dare type game, but you only had dares, and the sort of things you had to do, and these were very important, incidentally, though it sounds so childish now, I hardly like to say that. I remember having to go in front of the guard on all fours naked with some polish balanced on my behind, which was rather a frightening thing to do to start with, but then I managed to convey to them that I was stark raving mad, and like all Orientals, they rather respect madness, and nothing happened as a result of it. But
This was a tin of polish.
Yeah, tin of polish, which looked, I suppose it looked rather mad, actually, but on the other hand, these sort of things were done. The other sort of thing which was, be better coming later on, but this is more serious. In the job when we got to Sumatra, where really the hard work was in Palembang, do you want to...
Well, we'll go on to your move to Sumatra now.
Yeah.
And then... Or actually, before we move on to Sumatra, we haven't said anything about the cycle camp
that you were in. Well, better, yes.
Perhaps we can go on to the cycle camp.
Let's talk about that, yes. Well, the head started, it had been about a year, every year, in Java, and they started moving people out from there because there was an awful lot of work to do in Java from their point of view, and they sent, some went to Japan, most of whom I think died as a result. I don't think very many survivors from that. Some went up to Burma, there weren't many survivors from that. But group I was in, I don't know how we were nominated, incidentally. We were sent to Sumatra, but everybody who left Java went to Jakarta first, because that was the sort of exit camp, and you stayed there for the ships to take you wherever you're going.
Why did they call it the cycle camp?
Oh, well, it was a Dutch cycle regiment was stationed there before the war. It was again the beauty of Java, as opposed to other places we went to, were that the camps there were all, in fact, barracks, so that and they were tropical barracks, so that you got they were very airy. You know, they were much better than anything else. They were good shelters when it rained, and also B, they were airy when they weren't. The trouble with them was, of course, they were overcrowded. But in the cycle camp, that was run by a man called Sonny. Whether it was anything to do with the Sonny family, I don't know now. But there's no question about it. He was homicidal. He was an absolute maniac. In fact, he was hanged afterwards.
He was a commandant, was he?
Yes, he was the commandant. And he was really a most unusual type of man. One of the things, incidentally, put in parentheses here, that all the other ranks below sergeant were Koreans. Only sergeants and officers were actual Japanese.
Did that make any difference as far as you were concerned?
Shouldn't think so.
The fact that they were Korean?
No, I shouldn't think so. Except that I don't think I'm very sympathetic about in the Korean War when that came up. But on the other hand, since they all claim to come from South Korea, anyway, they're all from Hanoi.
From Seoul?
Seoul, I mean, Seoul, yeah. Anyway, this chap, he was an extremely good-looking man. That's an unfair thing to say, but what I really mean is he's very Western-looking. Very, very neat, very dapper. Spoke beautiful English, but in a slightly childlike way that he never, I would not, and you do not, didn't, no don'ts or wouldn'ts and so on, but very correct.
Very pedantic.
Very pedantic, but absolutely mad, really was. Some of it was quite funny in the sense that you had to work when you were there. Now, because he sort of said, Geneva Convention says that all other ranks must work. But fortunately, work included play or just beating at flies, you know, swatting flies or plucking grass or anything. So. And also, officers weren't allowed to work. They were sort of had to sit in a chair all day. Practically anything was work. And his punishments, though, weren't funny. His punishments, goodness knows how many people must have died as a result of his punishments. Well, his favourite was standing to attention in the sun. And you have 12 hours of that. It's no joke. You're very lucky to survive, as by that time you were pretty weak to start with. So he was a pretty brutal bloke. The other thing that he quite clearly was a bad sleeper, and he was very likely to come out in the night and have an inspection of the hair. Hair had to be no more than a millimetre, whatever it was. And he'd sort of stand on a chair and light on, and he'd pass underneath, and if he found anybody with more hair, have big shears and cut it off and scalp and everything.
He'd do that himself, would he?
Yeah, he'd do that himself. We had a bit of fun with him, though, if you can call it fun, because he used to come in the middle of the night and shouting, and we were all in there. We had to have there anti-malaria sheets, you know, which we hadn't had anywhere else.
Mosquito nets.
Mosquito net type things. They weren't really mosquito nets, but that was the purpose of them. And so we felt fairly anonymous, and we'd hear him coming, everybody would scream out at him, and he understood bad language, and he heard a lot, and he used to go start raving mad, throwing stones at us and all the rest of it, and at the finish, of course, again, he'd always win, because he'd have an inspection immediately, but on the other hand, we had the satisfaction.
But for what would he give these punishments of standing in the sun?
Oh, anything, breaking any of his rules. I can't remember all his rules now, but he had thousands of little rules. But on the other hand, he didn't allow anybody to steal our rations. We got our full rations there, which in many respects made us not unfriendly towards him. And oddly enough, he had a permanent staff there of Australians who absolutely adored him. though he accepted all this, but at the same time he treated them very well.
What did the staff do?
Oh, the kitchen, the cooks and so on. So they had jobs. But our great problem was, because we were only there for till a boat was ready to take us away, and so there was no particular work for us to do.
How did you know that Cerny was preventing the stealing of your rations?
Oh, this is simply, what we were told, and also we clearly did have not bad rations there. Certainly.
So this was a camp commonplace,
yes,
was it?
Yes, that's right. There's information like that one has no proof of, but it was pretty acceptable. The other interesting thing was that he didn't allow anybody else to hit us except himself. Unless that, but what the guards used to do, and on the whole, the guards were in fact more frightened of him than we were, because, God, he used to beat them around. And the guard, I can remember doing something wrong, I can't remember what, but whatever it was, a fair cop. And the guard said to me, "Would you like me to beat you, or would you like me to report you?" And he said it in such a quiet, commonplace way. Really, I suppose now it sounds rather odd. But, of course, I said yes, and he beat me. But I could have stood on my rights and gone to see Solly, but nobody in their right mind would do that. I mean, he really was the end.
Did you come across the Kempi tie in these camps or in any future
only,
ones?
No, well, not as far as I know. Only by hearsay. We were always told that they were around, but I don't know if they came in. Certainly I was never personally interrogated, though I heard somewhere, and I believe, again, it was rather sad that if you were an ordinary signaller, you were likely to be picked up and interrogated, because it was assumed that if you were a signaller, you knew all secret codes and everything. Whereas maybe they had a captain or a major or a colonel of signals there, who they wouldn't know about. So this was very sad. Though, as I say, I'm not. I was never personally concerned, I'm glad to say.
Could you tell me next about your move to Sumatra?
Yes. Yes, well, we met on a boat, which was a pretty horrific experience. Boat, I think, was called the France Maru.
France Maru.
Yeah, it looked it had been dredged up from the bottom of the ocean somewhere. Anyway, we were cargo on this because we had dumped whatever we were taking with us on the deck, and we had to go down below. And it was so horrific that it really became quite funny. In fact, everybody started roaring with laughter, believe it or not, because it went beyond the ability to take it seriously. It was impossible to lie down, for instance. You were just squatting down on the floor. And then there were some people, that was in the bottom hold where I was. Then the next hold up was even worse because they kept the hatches open, because obviously, unless we'd had air down, we'd have all been dead. And so there's one row of poor devils who'd spent the whole time sitting, dangling legs. Two lots and up. And it was totally disastrous, as you can imagine, the heat and the... nobody wanted to eat, but we did want to drink. How long did it take us? I think 3 nights and 2 days, which was a pretty ghastly experience. Except, as I said, that this is one of the cases where something which was so tragic suddenly turned to comedy, because nobody could really take it in, I suppose. But as far as I know, nobody died. But that's how we travelled to Sumatra, to Palembang.
Did you know you were going to Sumatra?
No, no idea. No idea at all.
And what happened to you once you arrived at Palembang?
Well, once we arrived at Palembang, there was an ordinary disembarkation. Though I was a bit unlucky there. I suppose being on the lower hold and fairly late out, I was kept on board to tidy up the place, which was a bit of a lousy job. But then we landed anyway, and we were taken by lorry up to this camp that I'm talking about, where we spent the main time, which was a brand new camp. It hadn't been opened before. Nobody else had been in it. So it was all right, except that some idiot who designed it put the latrines between the huts. His idea, so if you had a hut there, there'd be a latrine there, another hut there, a latrine there, which meant very rapidly, of course, the flies congregated like mad, and I would imagine at least 90% of us had dysentery at some time very quickly. And it sort of almost you could tell your turn as it came round. And it was only then that they sort of filled all these in and sort of built a latrine down there. But that was the major problem. As far as I'm concerned, that was the second time that I'd had dysentery. I'd had it once in Java. And, of course, it's a very weakening thing to have.
What were the other sickness problems that you had?
Malaria, and the other thing about the various malnutrition diseases. Beriberi, when you're on a diet of rice mainly, and then during the short period when you couldn't get rice, but they gave us equivalent of corn, not sweet corn, but you know, like those little beans you get on sweet corn, but they weren't very new, they're very old. You got pellagra and you had a diet of those. But beriberi was the main one.
Were there any drugs available?
Very, very few. I was lucky in Java. As I said, we had a lot of the hospital who'd brought drugs with them. Though, of course, remember that there weren't such things as antibiotics then. But when they ran out, they were never replaced. So they had to be very rationed indeed. What did I get? Yes, on one occasion, because I had malaria and dysentery at the same time, I was given one quinine pill.